concerts, jamming, and more banjos than you can shake a fiddle at.
Portland Old Time Music Gathering is a non-for-profit, family-friendly, volunteer-run celebration of the American old-time music tradition.
More information on how to volunteer, event times, locations, and lineup can be found at kboo.fm/oldtime2014.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
News. Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a state legislative committee hears testimony on how to regulate, not ban, the use of license plate cameras by law enforcement in Oregon.
The ACLU and the state of Oregon spar with the Drug Enforcement Administration over the federal agency's ability to obtain Oregonians' prescription drug records.
And we'll hear an update on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the attempt to fast-track it through Congress.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 16th, 2014. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Jen Chavez. On Wednesday, attorneys for the state and the Oregon branch of the American Civil Liberties Union gave oral arguments before senior U.S. District Judge Ancer Hagerty in a case that seeks to prevent the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration from obtaining the medical records of Oregonians without a court order. The DEA has issued administrative subpoenas for data from Oregon's prescription drug monitoring program and claims that a congressional mandate allows them to do so without obtaining a warrant from a judge in order to speed up investigations and avoid clogging the legal system with warrant requests. The Oregon ACLU fought the monitoring program when it first went before state lawmakers in 2007. It was passed in 2009 with safeguards that include a requirement that a judge sign off on the legality of all requests by law enforcement for data, including requests from federal agencies. The program tracks all prescriptions issued in Oregon for substances scheduled 2 through 4, which includes painkillers that contain codeine and drugs that treat mental illness. For more, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with David Fidanke, the executive director of the ACLU of Oregon.
When did the ACLU get involved with this suit, and what prompted you to get involved?
As soon as we learned that the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration was getting access to this database without obtaining a warrant first and felt they had a right under federal law to access the database based on an administrative
as soon as we sit in the chair.
Order from any individual DEA agent, the first we knew about that was when the state went to court to try to prevent this from happening and to get a federal judge to rule on the legality of what the DEA was claiming they had the authority to do. The DEA maintains they do not need probable cause that a federal offense has occurred in order to get access to this kind of private information relating to patients and the relationships, the confidential relationships they have with their physicians and with their pharmacies. We believe that to the extent federal law would permit the DEA to get access to this kind of information without a court order, that authorization is a violation of the federal Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable searches without a warrant. And a warrant, of course, they would have to show probable cause that they believe someone has violated federal law before they could go to a judge and get access to the data. We strongly believe that that should be the standard and is the standard under the Constitution. And so as soon as we learned about the state's lawsuit against the DEA, we started moving to intervene in that suit on behalf of a number of patients and one physician. And the court did indeed authorize us to intervene, and we had a hearing in federal court before Judge Ansler Haggerty yesterday in Portland on these constitutional issues. And I think that hearing went very well for our side of the equation. But, of course, we won't know until Judge Haggerty issues his opinion, and we don't know exactly how soon that'll happen.
The DEA has claimed that Oregon and the ACLU have not shown that they, the DEA, ever used an administrative subpoena to get specific medical prescription information, and that it is, quote, purely speculative to assume that they will, and therefore the judge should throw it out.
That's not quite what they've been arguing. What they've been arguing is that our clients, the three individual patients and the one physician, cannot prove that they were the target of any administrative subpoena.
I see.
The DEA has not said that our clients were not the target of any administrative subpoenas, but they're arguing that we wouldn't have standing to file a separate lawsuit against the DEA, and that may well be the case, but that's not the standard for us to be able to intervene on behalf of these patients and this physician. In a case that was filed by the state of Oregon, the standard for intervention is easier to meet than it is for having standing to file a separate lawsuit. And in any event, our attorneys argued to the judge yesterday that the judge doesn't need to reach the issue of our standing to reach this constitutional issue, because the first question that the judge should ask and answer is whether or not DEA has lawful authority to go after this kind of information without a warrant under the federal constitution.
Okay. David Fidanke, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Okay. Thank you.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with David Fidanke, Executive Director of the Oregon ACLU.
If you've been wondering if the NSA can get a copy of your medical records without your consent, the answer is apparently yes. Your private medical carrier is obligated to hand over your medical records to federal authorities if they claim it's in the country's national interest or to protect the president. Journalist Peter Van Buren from Fire Dog Lake interviewed a congressional representative about a government provision to covertly obtain health information from individuals. After much hesitation, the congressional representative admitted that he was not aware of this stipulation in the HIPPA documents. There is a lot that the government can learn about a person through medical records, including sexual preferences, a person's position on abortion, and other family secrets. These can all be revealed and evaluated by the government if they decide it's in the national interest. This is allowed because of a little-known clause in the Health Information Portability and Accountability Act, the HIPAA, more commonly known as the HIPAA law.
Today, in a landmark decision by a British judge, the Google Corporation was ordered to respect European users' privacy. The class action suit against the corporate internet giant was brought about by 100 internet users in the UK. The judge allowed the plaintiffs to sue Google for violating their privacy by placing cookies to track their online habits. In November of 2012, Google was hit with a fine by the Federal Trade Commission for well over $22 million for violating users' privacy in the U.S. In an effort to stop the lawsuit, Google claimed that the trial would need to be held in the state of California, where Google is headquartered. But the U.K. judge overruled that claim, stating that those who are seeking damages for privacy infringements are from the UK, and therefore the trial should be held in the jurisdiction where the alleged crime took place, that is, on the computers of the users in question. The judge also ruled that Britain can preside over internet privacy issues, but any injunction should be carried out through U.S. courts. He also determined that the cost of flying 100 claimants to the U.S. was an impractical measure attempted by Google to derail the lawsuit.
As Oregon state legislators gear up for a legislative session that begins next month, committees are meeting in Salem this week to draft legislation and prepare documents for the session. At today's meeting of the Interim Education Committee, a group of Chinese Americans raised concerns about the lack of awareness in the state of Oregon about the history of anti-Chinese discrimination here in Oregon. Here is a clip from that testimony.
Chinese Americans are virtually absent from history textbooks. Historical facts, such as the one that Chinese Americans served in the U.S. military, is largely unknown. Oregonian Hazel Ying Li, a Chinese American woman aviator in World War II, she actually taught men how to fly, which I thought was pretty cool. She was denied burial in Riverton Cemetery in Portland because the location was for whites only. Also little known is the magnitude of what Chinese Americans have contributed to the economic development of Oregon. Contributions of cheap labor spanning major industries added to the success and growth of the economy here in Oregon. These historic contributions have been underrecognized. In addition to their contributions as a result of their physical labor, they contributed significantly in the revenue generated for state and local governments. Although the lowest paid, the Chinese were the highest taxed. By 1858, taxes collected from the Chinese covered all local government expenses in southern Oregon's Josephine County. In Oregon's constitution, they were denied the right to own property. They were also denied the right to U.S. citizenship. And posters such as these really added to the anti-Chinese sentiment, all of which led to the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act. Chinese could no longer immigrate to the United States. They could not become naturalized citizens. And it was the first time in U.S. history a specific ethnic group was barred from immigrating. This is a photo of the preamble of the law. And this characterizes Chinese laborers as an imminent threat to, quote, good American order, unquote. Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act five separate times and made it permanent in 1904. And actually, this resulted in all Asians being barred from immigrating. The act was repealed in 1943 after 60 years when China became our World War II ally. The impact of this Exclusion Act legitimized discrimination towards the Chinese, which translated at times into violent action. One example in Oregon is the grisly massacre of 34 Chinese miners on the Oregon side of Hell's Canyon. Some bodies were found hacked to death and decapitated. The accused white murderers were found not guilty despite a confession. Other impacts were to families. Wives and children could not immigrate, thus condemning the Chinese men to a bachelor existence. These men could not live a family life here. The 1882 Project is a national movement led by the Chinese American Citizens Alliance. The goal of the project is to educate others about the Chinese Exclusion Act. Our own U.S. Congress apologized for this wrong in 2001 with the Senate and in 2012 with the House.
Students in their classrooms today learn about things such as war and genocide, usually in the hopes that the actions leading up to these things can be prevented. We even learn about phenomenons like economic depressions in an attempt to gain understanding and to improve in the future. However, we can only learn from these things we know about them. Personally, in over 12 years of receiving my public education, I've only heard the Chinese exclusion laws mentioned once. Even then, it was simply a brief afterthought to a PowerPoint in my U.S. history course in 10th grade. These laws were also never mentioned in any of my textbooks. Furthermore, I was shocked to find that even though my mother's side of the family is Chinese, none of them had heard about this law either, or about these laws either. Not even my aunt and uncle had heard of them, and they're both teachers. So the only way that the few people that I know have heard about these exclusion laws is through the Chinese American Citizens Alliance. Americans need to know about these events so that they can comprehend the struggles of all their ancestors. What concerns me the most, though, is that the past can easily be repeated if we never learn from it. Students should know all aspects of our country's history, even if they are considered shameful, because that's the only way we can stop such injustice from happening again. I wholeheartedly believe that the ignorance surrounding these laws is a dilemma and that we should try our best to fix it.
That was testimony from a hearing at the Oregon State Capitol today, calling for recognition at the state level of the history of discrimination against Chinese immigrants here in the state of Oregon.
Also in Salem today, the Senate Committee on General Government considered a legislative concept on a bill that would regulate the use of license plate cameras by law enforcement. Representative Jennifer Williamson is one of those who spoke at the hearing today.
The use of automatic license plate reader surveillance technology in the state right now demonstrates that the same surveillance issues and data collection that we know are occurring nationally are also occurring locally. And there are very legitimate uses for surveillance and data collection, and it can and does keep us safe, but we need to have smart policies to manage that collection and storage. It's a core principle in this country that the government does not invade people's privacy indiscriminately or collect data on citizens' innocent activities just in case they do something wrong. We are innocent until proven guilty in this country, and it's not the other way around. So I think it's time that we get ahead of this new technology. We create smart policies before this technology is more commonplace in the state than it is. And we figure out a regime in which we understand that the dissemination of this this information without limitations is not good policy. We know that law enforcement capabilities for systems that pool stored license plate information across jurisdictions is not far off in the state, and in some places in the country they're already using that. And if current trends continue, we will eventually see the construction of a national database, I believe, or interlinked databases allowing for intergovernment agency and possibly nationwide data mining of this information. So I think LC 205 is a modest bill, and it takes a pretty reasonable approach to managing this data collection and storage. It doesn't propose a ban on any surveillance technology, but it provides, I believe, clear, concise, consistent policy across the state to help law enforcement solve crimes and protect the privacy of our records and, you know, the records of our daily movement of Oregonians across the state.
The use of license plate cameras by law enforcement is already a reality in Oregon, but the proposed bill will not ban the practice. It will simply regulate the way that the information from license plate database is used.
Today, the Senate Finance Committee held a hearing discussing the president's fast-track authorities, specifically regarding the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. The TPP is a wide-ranging free trade agreement focused on Asian-Pacific economies, and it has been pushed by multinational corporations and by President Obama. The agreement contains 29 chapters, much of the material having been negotiated behind closed doors. Yesterday, WikiLeaks released the environmental chapter of the agreement. Although the agreement is being promoted by President Obama, he has yet to find Democratic support of fast-track legislation for the TPP through Congress. For more, we go to KBOO's Rachel Bennett speaking with Elisa Simmons, National Field Director for Public Citizens Global Trade Watch.
So first of all, do you want to just give me a rundown on the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Sure. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TPP, is a massive free trade agreement that's currently being negotiated behind closed doors. It's really important to highlight that, with the United States and 11 other countries. The Trans-Pacific Partnership has been under negotiation for about 5 years now. And, you know, the important thing to note is that the public, the press, and even with members of Congress, they can't see the draft of the text. But over 600 corporate trade advisors have full access. And it's also important to note that the Obama administration plans to sign this by early 2014. What we do know from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we know because of leaks. You may know that just yesterday, WikiLeaks released the entire environment chapter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And the more that we see from leaks, it becomes, you know, clearer and clearer that this so-called free trade agreement, the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, really isn't about trade. Of the 29 chapters, the draft chapters, only 5 deal with traditional trade matters. What we're finding out from the leaks of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that most of this deal would set rules on non-trade matters that affect our daily lives, like food safety, medicine costs, financial regulation, internet freedom, and more. The scary thing is that our domestic policies and those of other countries around the world who are involved in this trade deal, those domestic policies would be required to comply with this overwhelming or broad sweeping trade deal.
Today, there was a committee hearing to try to fast track the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Why are they trying to fast track it?
Yeah, so the hearing you talked about today was the first on a fast track bill. Before I kind of get into why they do that and why they want to fast track it, I just want to stop and make sure I explain what fast track is. Back in 1973, Richard Nixon cooked up this scheme called Fast Track. And what it does is take the authority over approving trade deals away from Congress and puts it in the hands of the administration. What's really important to highlight under Fast Track is that it takes 5 key congressional powers away. The power to select trade partners, the power to set terms and sign sweeping trade agreements before Congress votes on them, the power to write legislation to change all U.S. laws to conform with the trade deal. The president would also have the power to force votes within 60 to 90 days of submitting the legislation to Congress. The president will also have the power to override normal voting rules. So all amendments to trade agreements that are put on the fast track are banned. In the bill that was just introduced last week, debate on this overwhelming trade deal is limited to 20 hours. Fast track completely negates the checks and balances that were deliberately, included and sectioned out in the United States Constitution. And Fast Track, in its current form, in what was introduced last week, essentially puts Congress in a rubber stamping place in terms of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There would be no real debate. There would be no opportunity to amend it. And this would be the largest free trade agreement that the United States has ever signed. And we're saying that there needs to be more checks and balances, and there needs to be a public discourse about how this is done.
This has been Rachel Bennett with KBOO News, speaking with Elisa Simmons, National Field Director for Public Citizens Global Trade Watch.
To take action on this or learn more, you can visit the website stopfasttracknow.org.
U.S. Representative for Oregon Peter DeFazio will hold several forums to present his opposition to the TPP agreement. Forums will be at 5 p.m. Tuesday at the Boys and Girls Club in Corvallis, located at 1112 Northwest Circle Drive, and 6 p.m. Wednesday in the Fur Room at the U of O Memorial Union, 1228 University Street, Eugene. The TPP agreement has been described as NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, on steroids. NAFTA has been in full force since 2008 and has eliminated many trade restrictions between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. NAFTA made it easier for corporations to move production overseas in search of cheaper labor and with reduced workers and environmental safety protections. Negotiations on the TPP have been ongoing since 2010 and have included countries throughout the Pacific Rim. The treaty has been negotiated in complete secrecy, with even members of Congress relying on WikiLeaks to get any information on the huge agreement. Critics of the trade agreement include environmentalists, unions, health officials, and internet users. Critics say that if ratified, the TPP would give free rein to business interests at the expense of health and safety concerns. The deadline to complete the treaty in 2013 has already been missed.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with the Vaughs Work Center about a rally tomorrow afternoon, followed by Wisdom of the Elders at 6 p.m. At 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 55 and a low of 37. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 27 counts permitted in North Portland. Damascus has a count of 31 cpm with a high of 54. Powell Butte measures 26 cpm. In Raleigh Hills, the radiation count is 29 cpm with a high spiking up to 53. Seaside, Oregon has 32 cpm with a spiking high of 61. And Hanford, Washington has 28 cpm with a high of 49. Sitka in Alaska has a radiation count of 34 counts per minute, spiking to as high as 56. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information on this can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:29, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
There's a growing army of the working poor in our U.S. of A, and big contingents of it are now on the march. They're strategizing, organizing, and mobilizing against the immoral economics of inequality being hung around America's neck by the likes of Walmart, McDonald's, and colleges. Wait a minute. Colleges? You go there to get ahead in life. More education makes you better off, right? Well, ask a college professor about that. You know, the ones who earn PhDs and are now teaching America's next generation? The sorry secret of higher education, from community colleges to brand-name universities, is that they've embraced the corporate culture of a contingent workforce, turning professors into part-time, low-paid, no-benefit, no-tenure, temporary teachers. Overall, more than half of America's higher ed faculty members today are, quote, adjunct professors, meaning they are attached to the school but not essentially a part of it. It also means that these highly educated, fully credentialed professors have become part of America's army of the working poor. They never know until a semester starts whether they'll teach one class, three, or none. Typically, this leaves them with take-home pay somewhere between zero and maybe $1,000 a month. Poverty. Adjuncts usually get no benefits, no real chance of earning full-time positions, no due process or severance pay if dismissed, no say in curriculum or school policies, not even office space. Like their counterparts at Walmart and McDonald's, adjunct college professors are not treated as valuable resources to be nurtured, but as cheap, exploitable, and disposable labor. This is Jim Hightower saying, unsurprisingly, this contingent of the low-wage army is organizing too. For information, contact New Faculty Majority at www.newfacultymajority.info.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Last night in Ohio, a prisoner was executed using a drug combination that has never been tried before for lethal injections. It took approximately 15 minutes for Dennis McGuire to die. The whole time he was gasping for breath, according to reporters who witnessed the execution. McGuire's gasping is a medical phenomenon known as air hunger, which critics say is straight torture. Torture is prohibited under international law and the U.S. constitutional ban on cruel and unusual punishment. The three-drug combination used in past executions is currently unavailable in the U.S. since the manufacturer has refused to import a drug that will be used in executions. The manufacturer is based in Europe, where the death penalty is illegal. McGuire's attorney argued that state prison officials knew that his client would suffocate and suffer for a prolonged period and had asked for a delay of the execution for that reason. The delay was denied, and the execution was carried out as scheduled last night. Oregon currently has a death penalty in place, but Governor Kitzhaber has placed a moratorium on the death penalty while he is in office. For more on the story, KABU reporter Genevieve McDaniel spoke with Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.
What's the law in Oregon regarding the death penalty, also known as capital punishment?
The law in Oregon is on the books, but we are under a moratorium declared by Governor Kitzhaber back in November of 2011, which means there'll be no executions, but the mechanism, the laws are still on the books for aggravated murder. People are liable to get executed. That's the current law.
What is your organization trying to do about it?
About the death penalty, our efforts are primarily educational at this point, trying to get people to understand all of the things that revolve around the death penalty. It's a complicated issue, and most people don't know much about it. Some folks are adamantly in favor. Some folks are strongly opposed. Most of the people are in the middle because they just don't have enough information, and that's our task, is to create dialogue and let people learn about it and think about it and talk about it and then make an informed decision rather than just a gut feeling that we have to get rid of people who do bad things.
Can you speak to the execution that happened in Ohio last night with the never-before-tried drugs?
I only know what I've read in the media today, and it's an example of how misguided this whole process is. For those who maybe haven't read about it yet, they used a new protocol of drugs. The drugs that had been used in the past by states who execute have become unavailable. Companies that make them in this country have quit making them. They've tried to get them from Europe, and Europe refuses to sell them because European countries are very much against the death penalty. But they did an experiment last night. They used a two-drug protocol that had never been done before, and from the reports in the media, it took over 15 minutes to kill this man. We would get appalled if we heard about farmers taking 15 minutes to put down their farm animals or things of that nature, but the government seems insistent in some of these states to go ahead with risky business. The death penalty is flawed in many ways, and this is just another example of how misguided the whole process is.
If there were to be an execution in Oregon, do you think those drugs would be used?
I would certainly hope not. I would hope that we get rid of the death penalty altogether before Governor Kitzhaber leaves office. We would hope to have it repealed, but if for some reason it is not repealed and executions comes up, I would hope that people are a little more thoughtful about this whole process. Again, we are very much against any executions. We're very much in favor of supporting law enforcement. We do not coddle criminals. We think violent people should be separated from the rest of society, but we don't think that the government should be killing its citizens. The government's responsibility is to administer justice, not revenge.
Do you know what the status of the lethal injection drugs being used in the U.S.?
I would say it should be characterized with confusion. Even the doctor who originally created or invented or formulated the protocols that had been used before has been stated in the media today that said that there was no evidence that these drugs would work. It was a test. It was a total experiment on a human being, and we as the citizens of states that do this are responsible.
Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know?
Well, the thing we always try and do is get people to learn a little bit about the death penalty. Most people do not have a good sense of all the things that surround it, and there's lots to learn, and we have forums in different places around the state where people can talk about it and learn about it in a safe place. We respect other people's opinions, and they have a right to their opinion, but they also need to be informed so that they can base their opinion on facts and figures and studies and reality rather than just their gut feelings about revenge and retribution.
I have been speaking with Ron Steiner from Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. This is Genevieve McDaniel with KABU News.
A Virginia state senator who announced his candidacy for a seat in the U.S. Congress earlier this week may have a tough time distancing himself from controversial positions, including a statement that women who are raped by their husbands are not actually raped. According to Senator Black's religious beliefs, there's no such thing as rape within a married relationship, since a woman should always submit to her husband's demands. Discussing the trend of conservative lawmakers to promote controversial religious beliefs such as this one, and to find out what that may mean for women's rights in existing and upcoming legislation, KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Scott Berkowitz, founder and president of the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network.
The reason that I reached out to you today is I've learned that there is a politician at the state level from Virginia who contends that there is no such thing as marital rape. Your response to that position?
I think it's sort of delusional. It's well established. A couple generations ago, I think that was a fairly widespread belief, but it's now a crime in every state in the nation.
Is this becoming a pattern, a recognizable pattern within the realm of the elected?
Fortunately, I don't think so. I think it's a mindset that pops up here and there around the country, but it's so far from being the majority view that there's no chance of ideas like that getting legislated into law.
How many states have laws diametrically opposed to Mr. Black's position on this matter? And you've already said that every state in the union has laws against this?
That's right. I believe since 1993, it's been criminal in every state. So, it's somewhat surprising that it took that long, but we've definitely reached the point where it is a crime everywhere. Now, it should be pointed out there that just because it's a crime doesn't mean it's always prosecuted. It still tends to be all rape cases can be challenging to prosecute, and it can be even more so when it's spousal rape.
Is that due often to the blame being shifted to the victim?
It can be, yeah, and I think most when spousal rape cases are prosecuted, more often than not, it's a situation where the couple was separated or living apart, and so there's very clear evidence that the person who committed the rape had no business being in that place at that time. It becomes more challenging in other circumstances to prosecute. Although there's many good district attorneys out there that do successfully go after these kinds of cases.
What do you think is the best way to address the problem of religious beliefs of politicians conflicting with the law?
I think it's a very personal thing that every politician's got to decide for themselves, and voters are certainly going to take into account the positions of a candidate. I think this is an area where sexual violence is an area where religion is a help more than a hindrance. Every religion is opposed to this sort of vile behavior. And it often people learn that basic morality from churches and synagogues and religious leaders. So, I think we need to look to the religious community to help solve this problem.
Congress is reconvened. Is there anything on the legislative agenda with regard to sexual violence against women that folks should, get more information about?
Yeah, the most important bill that Congress is going to be taking up is called the Justice for All Act, and that contains some really crucial legislation that helps local police departments test rape kits, which is test the DNA evidence from open rape cases. Right now, law enforcement agencies are relying on that to be able to test the evidence in thousands of cases every year, and so and that law expires this year. So we're looking to Congress to renew that law, the Justice for All Act.
For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has called on Syrian rebel groups and the Syrian government to participate in peace talks scheduled for January 22nd in Switzerland. Russia, Britain, and the United States have called for the Syrian government and Syrian opposition to attend the so-called Geneva II peace talks. So far, only the Syrian government has agreed to attend. Recent infighting between different rebel groups has been blamed for the latest spat of violence in Syria. Some aid has also been allowed to come into the country for the first time in months. Supplies that could feed up to 10,000 people were brought into several Damascus suburbs this week. The Syrian government has placed some restrictions on its involvement in the peace talks, saying that the United Nations position is in conflict with the legal and political position of the state of Syria. Political analyst Kamel Wazne told Al Jazeera today that Iran and Saudi Arabia should participate in the talks as well because of their involvement in funding the different parties involved. Iran has had a role in supporting the Syrian government, and Saudi Arabia has provided arms and money to one faction of the opposition. After 3 years of conflict and the largest refugee crisis in the world, many Syrians are cynical about the idea that the talks will really bring about a lasting peace.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, January 16, 2014. Israeli bombardment targeting Gaza leave 5 civilians injured and soldiers in the West Bank communities and kidnap civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Four children and one woman have been injured on Thursday at dawn after Israeli soldiers carried out a number of airstrikes targeting eastern and western areas of Gaza City. Local sources announced that all wounded Palestinians suffered mild to moderate injuries and are gradually recovering. Israeli sources said that several shells were fired after midnight from the Gaza Strip towards Ashkelon. The Israeli army also claimed it bombarded a workshop used by Palestinian fighters to manufacture shells, in addition to bombarding what was referred to as a launching pad used to firing shells into adjacent Israeli areas. Palestinian sources said that the bombardment targeting residential areas causing the Israeli soldiers invaded the West Bank district of Bethlehem and the southern West Bank district of Hebron, kidnapping several Palestinians. Local sources said that the army invaded Aida refugee camp north of Bethlehem and kidnapped three Palestinians. Furthermore, soldiers invaded the southern West Bank city of Hebron and kidnapped former minister of local government, Isa al-Jabari. Moreover, several Israeli military jeeps invaded a Taiba town west of the northern West Bank city of Jenin and kidnapped two brothers. The two are members of the Palestinian security forces in the Jenin district. In Jerusalem, Israeli settlers escorted by occupation soldiers stormed Al-Aqsa yards on Thursday morning. Media office of the Al-Aqsa Foundation announced that the settlers roamed Al-Aqsa yards in a provocative way and performed their Talmudic prayers. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, January 16, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, the U.S. military and federal law enforcement agencies announced yesterday that they will be setting up an intelligence center in Bahrain to monitor and combat the growing Afghan drug trade, which threatens to destabilize the economy and legal system of Afghanistan when international forces withdraw at the end of 2014. The small island nation of Bahrain, located in the Persian Gulf, is already home to the U.S. Navy's 5th Fleet and has been the scene of a crackdown by the monarchy against protesters that were part of the Arab Spring. Also in Afghanistan, NATO forces admitted on Wednesday that a clearing operation conducted that same day in northern Parwan province resulted in 2 civilian deaths along with the deaths of 10 insurgents. The operation was conducted jointly with Afghan security forces and was intended to disrupt insurgent activities in the area and specifically target 2 senior Taliban leaders. 1 NATO service member was also killed.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories here at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Desiree Garcia, Terry Eaton, Rachel Bennett, Robin Ryan, Genevieve McDaniel, Barbara Nelson, and Jimmy Tardy. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Pat Epstein. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look us up on Twitter at KABU News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, hosts Ani and Lynn speak with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch about the upcoming fairness hearing on the Portland Police Federal Justice Settlement Agreement. At 9 on Veterans Voice, join Arlene, Bill, and Marvin when they will interview Gulf War veterans Ian Laval and Angie Hines. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 11, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for an interview with the Vos Workers Center about an upcoming rally tomorrow afternoon. Good night, Robert.
Good night, Jen.
Good night,
Good night,
Pat. Good night.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
What is the Vos Worker Rights Education Project for people who aren't familiar with it?
So Vos Workers' Rights Education Project is a worker-owned organization that strives to empower day laborers and immigrant workers to improve their working conditions, to really gain control of those conditions. We do that through community organizing, through leadership development, through community education, and our Worker Center is one of our programs. We also have a whole leadership development program, and we do a lot of advocacy work, advocating both for workers' rights and for immigrants' rights.
So how does it work if I am someone who's looking for some extra help and somebody that I could hire on a temporary basis, or if I'm a worker who's looking for a temporary position?
Yes. Well, you can call or come down to our Worker Center. We're open from Monday through Saturday from 7 in the morning to 2 in the afternoon. Our phone number there is 503-234-2043. Workers just have to come down. We suggest you come down first thing in the morning at 7 when we open, and that gives you a better chance of going to work that day. And as an employer, you can come or call anytime. And We're a nonprofit. We don't charge any money to the employer or to the worker. We're just bringing you together, and we're providing that moral support. We know our workers so that we can vouch for them. And there's a lot of employers who are faithful employers that come in regularly to pick up workers and can vouch for how good a service that is.
How has this service improved the conditions for the workers who just go out for a day of labor and who are involved
right.
in that kind of labor scene?
Well, it's improved things in a lot of ways. To begin with, as I mentioned, it's a safe, respectful place to look for work instead of staying out in the street corner in the elements and being exposed to harassment, both by the business owners that you may be standing in front of their businesses, also the police, immigration, any other law enforcement. It's also a great opportunity to come together and defend each other, defend and come together as a group and unite to support each other. So, for example, day laborers set a minimum wage at the worker center. They started at $10 an hour back in 2008 when we opened, and now we've gone to $12 an hour. And we also have the employer doesn't have to give much information, but they have to give some. We take a name, a phone number, and the address where they'll be working, where the worker will be working. So if there's any issues, we can always get back to the employer and the worker to help work it out. So there's been a lot less wage theft at the worker center than on the street corners. That's one of the dangers of working on the street corners, that you never know if you're going to get paid. With the worker center, it's a pretty sure thing that you're going to get paid, and you're going to get paid what was agreed on when the employer came for the worker.
Do you just mainly work with individuals, or are there construction companies or contractors that hire day laborers from your center?
There are a few. Yes, some of the smaller companies, when they're overloaded with work, they need to get the project done soon, quickly, they can come and get a little extra help to finish their project.
Have you had any issue with unions complaining that workers are taking union jobs, for example?
That's a great question. And actually, when we started the center, there was some resistance on the unions, thinking that this was going to be an unfair competition. And actually, we have won over quite a few of the unions. This campaign that we're on, you'll see those who come to the march and rally tomorrow, that there'll be some union people there, because several of the unions have come around and are supporting us now directly and publicly, because they realize that it's not a question of competition. The most of the jobs that day laborers are taking are not jobs that unions would ever be hired to do. They're short-term, they're relatively low-skilled, they are the whole point here, in fact, is for day laborers to have an opportunity to move in to a longer term job, which then could be with a union. So we'd like to work together and build those bridges between the, as you say, informal economy workers and the more formal workers. So there's no reason to be feeling like this is competition. On the contrary, we're working together, and as it's been said so many times, if we can bring up the people, the boats on the bottom, then it benefits everybody. We're raising minimum wages for everybody. We're increasing the standards of the work for everybody.
Many of the workers that participate in the program there are immigrants. Have you faced any involvement from the immigration authorities? Have they tried to, say, do any raids or anything like that?
No. We've been having a fairly good experience on that front. We don't know about people's immigration status. We don't ask. We do understand that most of the folks that use the center are immigrants, so they may or may not have legal status, but they are hard workers. And as long as they work hard, and, you know, the immigration authorities don't seem to care. There's other things that are more important to them in terms of people who are, you know, breaking the law and such. And these are guys that just want to work, and they have a right to look for work, and just like anybody else does. So we have had a respectful relationship with the immigration authorities, and no issues in the 5 years we've been open.
And do you have any women among the workers there at the Day Labor Center, or would women feel welcome and comfortable there?
We do have some women who come down to the Worker Center to look for work. There's not many of them. Most of the women that that we connect with jobs, we have on a list that can be called when work comes in. Because most of the women, they're looking for certain work, like cleaning, for example. And so if a cleaning job comes in, then we'll give them a call. It generally is a fairly male-dominated center, that's for sure. We would like in the future to be able to start a women's program, but we haven't been able to do that yet.
What is the current status of the land, and what is the potential for that to change?
Well, we are currently on a month-to-month lease. We're sitting, our worker center is sitting on city land, city-owned land, and the city was a big part of getting the worker center started to begin with. The city worked with us to set up the center over 5 years ago now, gave us some money to build the buildings that we have on, the temporary structures we have on the site right now, some money to operate the center, so we can say that this was a pilot project, shall we say, that the city started with VOS and the community as a whole and contracted VOS to run the worker center. And that first five-year lease has now expired. So now it's time to look at what we've done with the 5 years and decide where we're going from here. And we are saying that the worker center has shown it's very useful, and it's time to make this situation permanent. We are asking the city to turn over ownership to VOS so that we can actually build permanent structures that are much more functional. We actually have real bathrooms instead of porta potties. We can have a much better looking building that appeals to the neighborhood and helps our organization to do a better job of what we're trying to do here and benefit the community. So all we need to do that is to get this land owned by the organization so that we can get financing to build. And so we've been talking with the city officials for, over a year now, the mayor and the city commissioners and others, and we just need that extra push to convince them that this is really in their interest to make this a permanent arrangement.
How is the center funded right now, and how would that land be purchased?
Right. So the center, as I said, receives some funding from the city still. Most of our funding comes from private foundations, such as United Way, and some individual donations as well. Again, we're hoping that the city will provide us with the land without cost. We'd like to see that happen so that we can spend the money that we do obtain to build the building. But there are foundations that have expressed interest in financing the construction of a building. So we would definitely go into a capital campaign as soon as we have the green light to raise those funds to get that building built.
And again, that rally will be tomorrow on Friday, January 17th at 2 p.m. at the VOS Worker Rights Education Project at 240 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. That's just south of the Convention Center here in Portland. And the rally will be at 2:45, a march across the bridge to Right to Dream 2 and then on to City Hall.
That's right.
I want to thank you so much for joining us from the VOS Worker Rights Education Project. This is Jenka Soderberg for KBOO News.
It's 6 o'clock p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Wisdom of the Elders is up next.
Hey there, old-time music lovers.
KBOO is proud to help co-sponsor the 15th annual Portland Old-Time Music Gathering.
It's taking place January 15th through the 19th in multiple locations around Portland. 5 days of square dancing, concerts, jamming, and more banjos than you can shake a fiddle at.
Portland Old Time Music Gathering is a non-for-profit, family-friendly, volunteer-run celebration of the American old time music tradition.
More information on how to volunteer, event times, locations, and lineup can be found at kboo.fm/oldtime2014.
The community called upon the Albino Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform to inquire into the pattern and practices of the Portland Police Bureau. After a federal investigation of the Portland Police Bureau use of excessive force, the City of Portland negotiated an agreement on police reform. Does this agreement go far enough? Please join Dr. Audrey Terrell, president of the Portland NAACP and public advocate for the AMA Coalition, Kelvin Hall, on Prison Pipeline to hear our recommendations to reform the Portland Police Bureau. That's Prison Pipeline, January the 20th at 6:30 p.m.
We remember, we listen, we learn from those who have walked before us, from those who can teach us now. Welcome to Wisdom of the Elders. Every week we bring you stories and songs of elders and storytellers from the Native Nations of North America. I'm Arlie Neskahai of the Dene Nation. In the next hour, we'll visit with Pulitzer-winning author N. Scott Momaday of the Kiowa Nation, who speaks of sacred earth. Then we'll hear from Judy Bluehorse Skelton, who offers us health and healing from the plant world.
Native people have been using and working and have had a unique relationship with the plant people for thousands of years.
Then we join Paiute song carrier Judy Trejo for stories and songs from her great-grandmother.
The elders were the only people that accepted me. I was told that as a very small child, I had the ability to heal wild animals.
Stay with us for Wisdom of the Elders. You're listening to the Red House Family doing I Will Remember from their album Urban Indian on the Canyon Records label.